1 year on, investigators of the January 6th riots are still learning about who stormed the Capitol that day. Some were members of extremist groups, the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, white nationalist organizations, and right-wing militias. Digitally, they tend to live in an echo chamber of conspiracy theories and misinformation and lies, not just about the 2020 election, but also COVID and vaccines. In the past year, these groups have evolved, and Brandi Zadrozny of NBC News is here to talk about it. She covers misinformation and extremism. Brandi, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So after the insurrection, there was a lot of scrutiny of these extremists, of course. Former President Trump, who had done so much to encourage them, was banned from social media and then left office. So what happened to these extremist groups in the months after January 6th? Did they retreat or just go quiet for a little while?
A little of both. So right after January 6th, there was an initial high, right? People were coming home and still tweeting and taking videos, and seemingly they had done what they had been instructed to do, which is go to the Capitol and cause chaos. That quickly changed when people began identifying people who were at the Capitol using their own videos. Also, the mass arrests. There have been, I think, over 710 charges filed against people who entered the Capitol that day. So that and just general public negative scrutiny did a lot to send these movements underground following January 6th. Now, that cooling off period only lasted for a couple of months before leaders in the far right space, people like Steve Bannon, started to instruct his podcast listeners, for instance, to take back the country village by village.
At the school board level, right? At the county supervisor level, at the precinct level, we're going to take this back village by village, precinct by precinct.
So that's the first time we started hearing a sort of go local approach. And from QAnon to militia orgs to street fighting gangs like the Proud Boys, this is a tactic that we've seen across the board these groups take up.
So you're describing this adaptation to some degree by design, or at least, you know, there are some who are seen as heads of this who are trying to direct this. When you look at the messaging then of these groups, what is the messaging now? What does it focus on? Like vaccines and masks or books in school? They've pivoted, as you're describing, a little bit from the election.
Yeah, because there is no national election now, right? So what can unify disparate groups of extremists? And what can engender empathy or relationships with more mainstream conservatism? They are issues like vaccines, race, education, really the culture war debates.
Any examples you've reported on that you can tell us about exactly how this is playing out?
Yeah, so the Pacific Northwest has always been sort of a hotbed of extremism. And so what we've seen this year is groups like Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys, they're taking up these local issues. So Vancouver, Washington, public schools had to go down into lockdown after Patriot Prayer spread this rumor that a child was facing arrest for failing to wear a mask. But that, you know, false claim was really picked up by the Proud Boys. It resulted in this impromptu protest against masks outside of the high school that actually had to lock down the schools. There's another one in October in Colorado. A militia filed into a school board meeting to oppose mask mandates. And we've been seeing this all over the country. Proud Boys showing up at school libraries to protest so-called LGBTQ books, things like that, just over and over again.
How is this messaging being spread? A recent ProPublica investigation found that extremist content on Facebook, you know, grew significantly between the election and the insurrection, and yet there's been a crackdown by a lot of these big social media platforms to ban extremist content. Are the extremists finding new digital ecosystems?
So extremism exists on a spectrum. So Facebook, for instance, can easily identify Proud Boys and can ban them from the platform. Same with mostly QAnon, same with militias. So although the sort of ringleaders of the violence are gone, the messaging, the disinformation that fuels that extremism is still very alive on the platform today. But to your point, far-right extremists have bolstered their online communities by evading these bans and either joining alternative platforms like Gab or like Parler, and or in some instances, they're actually creating their own. We've seen white nationalists create their own streaming platforms when they were banned from others after the 6th. And in this way, they can continue to make money off of streaming when they're banned from YouTube. And so this is how they're sustaining their movement online. And they've been really good at that. And the downside of that is that on January 6th or January 5th, we could easily see the threat. But as these groups move to increasingly smaller, more alternative platforms, it gets harder to keep a handle on all the activity.
You have been reporting on misinformation and extremism for years. Has any of this surprised you, either the attack on January 6th or how extremists in the years since have adapted and survived?
I think not surprised, but shocked. I'm continuously shocked. I actually spent the majority of this afternoon just watching ProPublica's video coverage from Parler videos, the events of the Capitol captured by rioters themselves. And it is incredibly alarming. And I think that that's so important to continue to be shocked by this, because a big piece of disinformation is that January 6th was no big deal, right? And I think that I fall into that trap too, not thinking that it was no big deal, but thinking that this is our new normal. And I think it's important to always realize that this is violence, and online violence begets real world violence.
Brandi Zadrozny is a senior reporter for NBC News. She covers misinformation, extremism, and the internet. And we will link you to her reporting at hereandnow.org. Brandi, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Scott.